Time for another Blind Like Me, and I'm, of course, Phil Parr, and our guest is Bradley Kimbrough from Starkville. Starkville? Pronounce it. What is it? Stark.
Down here, they say Starkville. When I came to town a year and a half ago, I was saying Starkville, but they've shown me they know when you know how to say it, it's Starkville, Mississippi, where
Starkville.
The campus of Mississippi State is.
They drop that vool and make it, call it Starkville. Woodville. We have Woodville here. Now the natives call it Woodville. Anyway, you are a professor at that college?
I'm director of training at the Rehabilitation Research and Training Center on Blindness and Low Vision, which is housed in the College of Education of Mississippi State. We have some classes here, but they're usually, we don't directly teach students. We teach, for instance, rehabilitation counselors. We have a class of counselors coming in March to learn a little bit about working full-time with blind and low-vision clients, and I'll be teaching them access technology.
Okay, so you teach the people who teach.
That's exactly right.
Basically.
Most of my jobs, I've been able to work, you know, directly with consumers and users, and as a consumer myself, I feel most comfortable when I'm doing that. And in the center here, we're a resource for professionals in the field, mainly. We don't get to work with consumers as often as I'm used to.
Now, you do this training for the state of Mississippi or for...
We're federally funded. Our funding comes from the National Institute on Disability and Rehabilitation Research. You know, you have all these acronyms in government work. They pronounce it NIDR, N-I-D-R-R. And so the priorities around here are whatever that federal institute, NIDR, says they should be. And as I say, mostly our work is directed to help rehabilitation professionals, rehabilitation teachers who... want to do research, want to find out about past research, want to know whether legislation that affects people who are blind or people who have other disabilities, whether that legislation is working the way it was intended. So we can sometimes even be a resource for Congress, bless our hearts.
Yeah. To let them know whether what they've mandated for institutions is actually doing any good or not.
Something like that, yeah. Right.
My, that's something that I did not know the federal government really cared about.
Well, Phil, it's like so many of the jobs I've had. It's nothing that I ever set out to prepare to do.
Yeah.
And, you know, my whole career has been kind of waking up, finding myself doing something interesting that puts together some of the things from the last career, but they very seldom are anything that I actually set out to head for.
Okay.
When I went to school, I was a music student.
Oh,
that's,
really?
That's what they would send people to school to do way back in the 1960s.
And, but now, let me get away from this. Just one more question or two. You say you're the access technology person. Do you actually teach other people how to teach blind people how to use computers or not?
In this case, where we'll have rehabilitation counselors who want to specialize with blind and low vision people, I show them how it works, because a lot of times the counselor has an awful lot to do with what money is spent or not spent. And
sure.
I want them to understand what the strengths of the technology, what you can really expect from it, what its limitations are, and how to translate some of the wonderful things that vendors and manufacturers say about this stuff. Right before I came here, I was vice president of Enabling Technologies in Florida. I did that for... Actually, I was with Enabling and their... previous namesake, Triformation, off and on since 1983. So I helped develop products, and I wrote marketing literature, and I established customer support for the company, and I understand the vendor's point of view. And so I've become a trader, Phil. I'm now showing the people how to work with the vendor's point of view and use it to the benefit of the consumer and the professional.
Yeah, so that a person buying a computer or buying some access technology for a blind person would know kind of what to buy and what they would expect, what they could expect from that.
Exactly. That not equipment. Saying for 1 minute that people are in this business to rip somebody off, because they're not.
Oh,
but
no,
they, but certainly
not.
When they when they tell possible buyers and tell consumers information, they tell it from a perspective that serves their interests.
They shed the best light on it, of course.
And they, they tell them information that tends to help them process it the way they want them to. Well, you know, the professional or the user has a set of questions that don't quite correspond to the information that, that the manufacturer wants to volunteer. So I just help them to be ready to ask questions to find out the rest of what they really want to know. So they don't come away dazed. They come away with a real good idea of what this device is and what it ain't.
And what it'll do.
Yeah.
Okay, let's walk, as we usually do, back to your beginnings. Where were you born? What, first of all, what is your level of vision?
I've got bare light perception. And I used to say it was enough to get me in trouble, so I sort of quit using it. I can tell when the lights go on and off. So functionally, I'd say I'm a total. And I was blinded at the age of 9 months when I was in a walker, and we had a home with basement stairs. And the curiosity of 9 months old knows no bounds. My grandmother was going downstairs to do the wash, and they tell me that they locked the gate and did everything they could, thought I was going to stay upstairs in the kitchen, but I tried to venture down and see what that was all about. And by the time they figured out what the fall had done, some pressure on the optic nerve had caused what they call optic nerve atrophy. So the doctors told my family when I was a couple of years old that they should get me educated as a blind person, and that that vision wasn't likely to change, the little bit of vision that I had.
Now, this was back in '40s.
That's right. I was born in 1943, so this would have been back in
45. Yeah. Just after the big war.
That's right.
And I guess at 9 months, you weren't showing any visual acuity anyway. I mean, you didn't do anything with your eyes in the first place, so it took them a while to figure out that they weren't working.
Well, that's perceptive. I think it did take them a while to figure it out. I think they hoped everything was fine. I think they took me to the hospital to make sure after the fall, but they didn't find any basic things they thought were to be worried about. And it took some time for it to be clear that I wasn't responding to moving objects and those kinds of things.
So basically, you've been blind all your life. You have no memory of anything.
People ask me, you know, you've been blind all your life, and I give the classic answer, not yet.
Yeah, but, not yet, I haven't.
Just since I can remember, because I certainly don't remember before 9 months.
Well, there's people say you lived here all your life. Well, So where'd all this take place?
In Louisville, Kentucky, which, of course, they all say Louisville up there. And I lived there until I was about 30 years old. Have hardly been back since.
And that, of course, is where the printing house is.
Yeah, I went to school at the School for the Blind there through the 10th grade, and I remember breaking numerous windows at the printing house, and some of the old-timers up there remember it, too.
Why were you hitting baseballs or doing what?
The printing house is next door to us, and our capacity to find places to play ball that weren't designed for playing ball knew no bounds in those days. And so whether it was kicking a football where it wasn't supposed to be, or hitting a bad basketball or a soccer ball.
Yeah,
we did for some windows in APH.
So APH is right next to the School for the Blind in Kentucky.
Yeah, I remember Phil laying up there with the flu a time or two in my dorm room. We could hear those plate-making devices clicking away over in the printing house. So whenever I hear those stereotype machines, it almost lulls me to sleep, because that's what I associated with, laying up there with the flu and having them darn things.
I didn't realize that they were that close together. Was the printing house, was it an offshoot of the blind school? Is that how it got started?
That's right. I read that back in the 1840s, when the school for the blind started, I believe, first, and the printing house actually started in some basement rooms of the school to begin with, until they got their own building.
They were printing them some Braille, but they wanted to print them some Braille books.
Yeah, so I think it did start in the same place, and they still are mighty close together.
Yeah, and they do a lot of, I guess, a lot of book reading there. Almost every book I read comes from the studios of the American Printing House of the Blind.
They do a ton of that, and most of those people are radio announcers or actors who you're familiar with in Louisville. So I grew up just expecting that the talking book readers would all be familiar voices.
Yeah, because they were to you. You heard them
and
all
they
the
were
radio
at that time. Now that I've left town, of course, they're not familiar anymore.
All right, so you started the school, the Kentucky School for the Blind, learned Braille, and I bet you're a good Braille reader.
I'm a lifelong Braille reader, and I wouldn't know what to do without it. And they were all people were telling me all that stuff when I was in school. I was so busy playing basketball after they turned the lights off when I was in school that they couldn't get me to sit down and read very much. See, I thought, Phil, that most that there wasn't going to be much material in Braille when I got out of school. Braille books were rare. I mean, you know, you talk about when you're young, you always say the Dark Ages, but Braille books were really only available maybe from NLS, very occasionally, mostly from the printing house when you were in school. When I went to public school, when I went to college, we had a lot of trouble getting Braille text. I didn't think there was going to be that much Braille material. I was thrilled and delighted when, you know, in mid-career I started finding out that some of this technology was going to generate so much more Braille.
Well, yeah, now it does.
It became, it became something that I worked on, sort of in the middle stretch of my life. Worked on building up my speed because I realized, hey, there's going to be a lot of Braille after all. And so I really fell in love with Braille long after I left school. And now, you know, I'm just head over heels about the stuff. Wouldn't know what to do without it.
Do you read books in library books in Braille?
Yeah, I tend to read them on refreshable displays.
Okay.
Now, but I one of the things that I do at the center here is look at all the Braille. We hand out a lot of Braille. A lot of our presentations, PowerPoint presentations, are in Braille. And a lot of the materials that we use in classes, we pass out in Braille. So I wind up reading a tremendous amount of hard copy Braille here. And when I was at Enabling Technologies, who make Braille embossers, I handled a lot of their Braille, the publications, the manuals, and those kinds of things. That was part of what I did. So, I read a ton of Braille in hard copy, and I read from web Braille stuff off of refreshable Braille displays.
Mm-hmm. You alluded to music a while ago. Tell us about that. How did that get started, and what do you play?
I'm a keyboard guy. I started studying piano when I was 8. I fell in love with the organ, and to my piano teacher's great unhappiness, I began to spend what little time I would practice on the organ instead of the piano.
Uh-huh.
And I was an organ student in college. My bachelor's and master's degrees are in organ. I learned Braille music. We couldn't get nearly as much in Braille musically either in those days as we can now, but I love Bach, and we could get hold of most of the works of Bach, so I spent most of my time as an organ student playing Bach, which I really enjoyed. I knew perfectly well it wasn't going to be how I made a living, even though the rehab folks kind of pretty much sent me there, because that was the going idea in those days. If a person has a little musical talent, you know, send them to school and that's the living he'll make. There were not nearly as many careers being looked at as legitimate for the blind in those days as there are now. But I was a stubborn guy, Phil. I didn't care what they thought. I wanted to be in radio, and I was always going to figure out a way to do that.
Well, you wanted to be in. You had a double-edged sword there. I bet the blind school. Our blind school had a wonderful pipe organ that was a real organ.
Ours did too.
And I wasn't ever very good at it, but I played it a little bit. But it really sounded like an organ supposed to sound, like a big church, you know, that you hear in the big Baptist church.
I thought that ours was big in those days. Turns out, as compared with the others some of the others I've seen, it was smaller than I thought. But we did have a fair size pipe organ in our auditorium before they tore that building down in our school.
And you also got bitten by the radio bug at an early age.
Yeah, I mean, from the time I could listen to it.
Yeah.
I knew that's what I wanted to do. They wouldn't even talk to me about it.
No, they wouldn't.
And the rehabilitation folks wouldn't even listen to it. And, you know, my parents were just sure that I couldn't make that work. But you always can if you use your opportunities and you're kind of patient, but you keep wanting it for long enough. You can always find a way to do it. When I was in college as a music student, I heard one of my music history teachers say one day that he had to go down and record announce the selections for our listening assignments. And I said, you know, you don't have to do that. I'm really interested in learning how to do that. I'll go and do that for you. And he was a very supportive guy. I thought at the time I was doing him a favor. I wasn't smart enough to realize he was doing me a favor. He knew perfectly well I wanted to learn how to do it, and he let me have the opportunity. It was a radio program that not many people except the students listened to, but it gave me a chance to cut my teeth.
You were I'm not clear on what you were recording.
Well, music history had a signed listing of a bunch of classical pieces and a bunch of pieces from the Renaissance, and so I'd have to get the composers and the performers and the names of all the pieces written down in Braille and then go and announce them. And they'd splice in the announcements. Actually, it was a radio station operated by the public library in Louisville. They don't operate it anymore, but in those days, that's where it was, in the Louisville Public Library. So I showed up one day down there, and they didn't know what to do with me at the time, but I became very friendly with all the people who worked down there, and they would help me get the stuff written down. The engineers didn't have a lot to do. They were just sitting there waiting for the tapes to run out so they could change tapes, so they would dictate the stuff to me. And you know, if you hang around long enough, you can almost always find somebody who will help you. And I got a lot of help in those days from those nice folks down at the library. And as I say, it allowed me to learn how I sounded on tape. Terrible. At first, I couldn't stand to listen to myself.
Yeah, I know the feeling.
all you really have to do is compare what you hear from yourself to what you're hearing other people do. And, pretty soon, you're figuring out what you're doing wrong.
And, you know, you're right. If you hang around long enough, you'll find somebody that'll teach you something, and you'll find a way to do what you want to do. If you're tenacious enough.
Opportunism is good.
Yeah.
For those of us who are looking to do things that we're not supposed to be able to do.
You know, my intro was buying. I went to a little radio station and bought 2 hours a week. And pretty soon they decided I was probably as good or better than anybody they had, and they hired me. And that's how I got in radio, and that's absolutely true. I mean, that's, you know, that's how I did it. Let's take a little short break here, and we'll come back and continue Bradley Kimbrough's life and how he did it and where he's been. I'm Phil Parr. Be right back for Blind Like Me. Hang on. A website our crack research team certifies screen reader friendly. Now, with this week's Blind Sites, here's Tim Cummings.
Have you ever been looking for a product for your home office, like maybe a paper shredder or an electric stapler or something like that? Well, you should take a look at Staples.com. Staples, of course, is the big office chain that sells a lot of office supplies and other products, and they are on the web at www.staples.com. The site's very accessible. We've ordered a couple different products from them. They have very good service, very quick turnaround time from the time that you place your order to the time that you get your product. I would give them a screen reader friendliness rating of a 9. For Blind Sites, this is Tim Cummings saying, keep on blind sighting.
If you found a screen reader friendly website you'd like us to mention, send your email to blindlikeme, all one word, at txucom.net. And join us again next time for Blind Sites. Know about the Blind Handyman Listserv?
The thing I like the best about the Blind Handyman List, great place to exchange information and gather ideas on anything to do with being a handyman around the house.
I found out how to fix my garbage disposal on the Handyman List. And it works.
If you'd like to join the Blind Handyman List, send a blank email to blindhandyman-subscribe@yahoogroups.com. That's blindhandyman-subscribe@yahoogroups.com.
The thing I like about the Blind Handyman List, I'm the moderator, and I can delete you if I want to. So don't get out of line. Stay on topic.
That's blindhandyman-subscribe@yahoogroups.com.
Our guest is Bradley Kimbrough on the Blind Like Me show, and I'm Phil Parn. We're just discussing music and those kind of things and opportunities for blind people. So you went and got a music degree from the University of what? University of Louisville.
Right.
And like you said, what did you think you were going to do with that music degree?
Well, it's a degree in what they call applied art. So mostly what the other people who had it did was they would probably teach their selected instrument at some other university. And I actually applied for a couple of jobs. And in fact, for a while, Phil, my teacher was very good to me. My organ teacher had a job just down the road, about 40 miles, in an Episcopal church in Frankfort, and he was moving to Louisville, and he recommended me for his job, and it was the job of a full-time organist choir director.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually took that job, and I tried very hard to put all of my ingredients of my personality into it. I tried to shoehorn myself into that job, even though it was very hard to get materials and braille, and we had several different choirs we were supposed to work with, and actually, one of the jobs was to conduct concerts with a community orchestra and a large volunteer chorus. And I loved that. And, of course, I could get some material for them to work on, not in Braille, but in form that I could learn.
Uh-huh.
But it was very, very difficult to get it.
How did you conduct? I mean, did you actually conduct the choir?
In school, they made us, all of us graduate students, take conducting class. And the teacher worked with me some, showing me how the gestures looked and how big to make them, and how you could make them subtle. A blind person really wouldn't understand much about the subtlety of gestures. So my conducting teacher was very patient with me. And Baroque music, and mostly we were conducting we were performing 18th century music. It doesn't require nearly the dynamic activity and the retards and kinds of things that the grand 19th century music would do. So I was apparently an adequate conductor for, visually speaking, for this 18th century music. And as I said, I was a great lover of Bach. I really enjoyed it. So I really put my whole life energy into it for a while. And we gave a couple concerts. And I didn't get a great recording. I had tape recorders in those days, and I didn't have quite enough attention left from preparing the choir and so forth to make great mic placement. So I made the best placement I could, and it sounded pretty good. But it just wore me out because it was so hard to get materials. And and it wasn't just the choir with orchestra that I was supposed to work with, several different kiddie choirs, and the variety of music and the volume of music that I needed to learn and keep up with. This would be the late 60s.
Yeah.
We just didn't have the technology to do it unless you happened to have somebody in your family that would be willing to, or you had volunteers. And, that wasn't the situation. So after I'd been at it for a couple of 3 years, I got an opportunity to make myself a job. Guess where? In radio in Frankfort, Kentucky. They have a radio station down there, WFKY. And I talked them into hiring me as the news director. The news in the late 60s, anybody who remembers the late 60s will know that most of the news was bad. There were a lot of assassinations and a lot of riots and a lot of not very happy things happening.
Yeah, they were. I know. I remember.
And that's what I was covering. Of course, Frankfort is the capital of Kentucky.
Yes, it is.
Part of what I did was to cover the state legislature beat just across the way over there in Frankfort.
Well, before we get away from the church, I want to just, I don't know if I read this or if someone I interviewed told me that they were conducting one time, and he got to thinking, are these people really paying attention to me, or are they just, what are they doing? So in the middle of something, he just stopped. And they all stopped. And he knew then that they were actually paying attention. I don't know if I read that or I don't. And he said it was just thrilling for him because he realized they were actually paying attention to what he was doing.
Well, there were two times, Phil, that I could know that they were actually looking at me. One was when I brought them in. And the other one was when I cut them off. The proof for a conductor is do you get precise attacks, and do they all cut off at the same time?
Yeah.
And so that was my way of finding out if they were paying attention. And what was really tough for me in rehearsals with the string players and the wind players was to learn the way their scores were marked, so I could say two bars from letter A, you know, or eight bars after letter A, so we could all start in the same place.
Okay.
That actually took me as much work as anything. So when we were going to have the rehearsal with the orchestra, so I could cue them in right.
You know, but you had a sighted person teach you how to conduct, because I remember, you know, I was 45 years old, and my wife, the lady I'm married to now, taught me how to wave to goodbye. I'd never seen anybody wave, so I just kind of held my arm out. I don't know what I did, and she said, well, that's wrong. Here, let me show you. And it's really weird, you know, a 45-year-old, you know, because I'd never seen anybody do that. So
I know,
how would I know?
Well, when I was in school, I missed the last bus because I stayed with my girlfriend too long,
yeah.
And I put my thumb up. I had no idea how to do it. I went across this busy street at midnight, and I put my thumb up, and some friends of mine stopped and said, they're going to arrest you and take you to jail the way you're holding your thumb. You got to learn how to do this. So I know just what you mean. So they gave me a ride home was the way the story ended.
All right, so you quit the church job. The church job was different. And they made you news director at this radio station, even though you couldn't read the wire.
That's exactly right. We had United Press International Audio, which probably without that I couldn't have gotten that job. But, you know, United Press International Audio would come down the wire about three times a day. They'd send you a bunch of
feeds, little actualities.
What they'd call actualities, which would be nothing in the world but quotes from people who were prominent in the news. And I've been a news junkie all my life, so I didn't have to rip the wire to know that I was hearing from Lester Maddox, the governor of Georgia. I knew who those people were, so it was easy enough for me to, occasionally I'd run into a voice I didn't know, and I'd find the teletype copy and go in and ask the guy who's running the board, who is this? But it didn't happen more than once a week.
And you listened to the news enough that you could write your own copy, your own news? News.
Absolutely. In those days, I was just an absolute news junkie. I mean, you know, I wanted it so bad I could taste it, so I lived, ate and breathed the news in those days.
Well, and this wasn't New York City.
Nah,
this was Frankfort, Kentucky.
That's exactly right.
And so you had obviously you have a good voice, and that means a lot in radio. Your delivery was good, so you were able actually. Was this? You were actually on the air? Good evening. I'm Bradley Kimbrough with the news at 5.
Oh yeah, I used to do the 5 o'clock news with the guy who owned the radio station, whose name was Bob Dahl. And incidentally, this is part of the story, Bob. I found out when I left, Bob was a guy who only could see about 10%. I mean, he was close to legally blind. When I first talked to Bob Dahl, the station owner and part owner and general manager, about working there, he said, a blind person can't do this. And I proved him wrong, and he used to say publicly how happy he was that I did. But the rest of the story was the guy was almost blind himself. That's why he thought a blind person couldn't do it. He couldn't see his copy very well. But he didn't use any blindness skills. He didn't think of himself as blind. He just wore really thick glasses. And so, you know, very often the people who want to tell us something can't be done are just about have our same situation, but they have a very different point of view.
Well, and he probably learned a lot from me. He learned it could be done if he completely lost his eyesight.
I got the idea that he did. I got the idea this was not something he really wanted to think about or face, but once it came up, he was real proud of having a blind guy. And he used to talk up that fact and talk up what I was doing to almost the point that it embarrassed me. So he turned out to be real proud of it after all.
Now, this radio station was a little rock and roller or country or what?
Yeah,
were they?
We were middle of the road. We had country in the morning and middle of the road stuff in the afternoon and rock and roll at night. So I pulled a news shift and I started at noon with the big news, and then I'd do a one to three. I'd do a record show. And then I'd do drive time news and an interview show at 6 o'clock. I was exhausted by the time.
So you were also a disc jockey on this radio station.
I didn't do rock and roll very often. I did our middle of the road stuff.
And you knew that music from growing up on it.
Yeah, that's right.
You knew when you queued up a Rosemary Clooney song, you knew who she was.
I knew exactly what it was. In fact, I did remotes, Phil, and they would. I didn't take the turntables with me. I'd go out there, and they'd start the tune, and I could always...
You could identify it.
Identify it as soon as it started rolling. In fact, they played games with me. A couple times they played new tunes. So I got to where I tried very hard to keep up with what they were going to do.
Yeah, but even if they played a new tune, you know how to ad-lib around it. You'd done enough. So you did a disc jockey show, and then you'd go and you'd prepare your news. And at that time, they probably had a lengthy news at 5, maybe a 15-minute or 30-minute.
Bob would do the local news, and I would do the national news. And because we were always competing with each other, we almost always ran over. It was a station that we didn't do much network, and we didn't have anything from the network in that hour from 5 to 6. So if we ran over, it just made the sports start late. So, we usually wound up with about a 20-minute news.
And he owned it, so what's the difference?
Heck, yeah, who's going to say anything to him? That's right.
How long did you hang with that little job that couldn't have paid much?
$100 bucks a week, and they thought that they were making me rich.
All the records you can eat.
That's right.
That's the deal.
I was there for 2 years, and at that point, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting was about to found National Public Radio. And so this little station I'd worked with in Louisville in college that was operated by the library got a grant to get somebody to announce all their classical music and pay them. And I got the grant. They decided to hire me. And it did that for 2 years.
Went back over to the little college radio station.
Well, and it was off the campus at the Free Public Library of Louisville, but it was becoming an independent public radio station. In fact, they had two little stations, WFPL, which stood for Free Public Library, and then WFPK, which was the all music station. And they're still there, although they're not under library ownership anymore.
Yeah, I mean, they were going to run. And now, I don't know, when did they start National Public Radio? What year are we
about
talking about?
1970.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, I came late to that. I love it. It's what I listen to all the time now, but I didn't realize. Linda Wertheimer, by the way, is doing Morning Edition now.
I know. It's real neat.
I'm glad to hear her back.
I'm a big fan of Linda Wertheimer.
I'm glad to hear Linda Wertheimer back, so Garrison Keillor has someone to make fun of.
He does, too.
He does.
And he loves to make fun of Linda.
Okay, so you went back to the college station, and you were doing what there? You were just talking there?
I was there for
a
couple of years, announcing all the classical music, and because public radio was looking for feeds from the local stations, they didn't have a lot of the shows they have now, but they were looking for news actualities, and so we'd make several news feeds a month, and I was mostly in charge of going out and doing those. I used my news gathering experience to do that.
This was back in Louisville.
Yeah, from 1970 to 72.
Okay, and it's about time for you to make some money, because this couldn't have paid much either.
Well, in 72, Dialogue Magazine, which was just putting in its own studios, Dialogue Magazine for the Blind, putting its own studios in Illinois, in the Chicago suburb of Berwyn.
They actually had a studio, Dialogue?
Their own recording studios. They got some money from the Lions and from friends of Ann Landers. Yep. And they offered me the job of studio director. And then I became managing editor. I was there for, I worked with Dialogue off and on from then, from 72, actually, until 1987, when they stopped publishing in the Chicago area. And that's where I got to learn about technology, because at Dialogue, you could kind of dictate your own specialty. I mean, once I'd gotten the recording studios going and we had some Revox tape recorders and we figured out how to edit our interviews and we got that all done, you could sort of dictate your own specialty. And as time went on, it became clear to me that eventually there was going to be some real interesting technology for the blind. So that's where I began to be able to start learning about that big time.
And they actually did the recording of Dialogue, put it all together, and then did the cassette duplicating to send out to magazine subscribers.
We didn't do cassette. We sent them to Evitone over in Deerfield.
For sound sheets.
Put on those little flexible discs.
Yeah, Evitone sound sheets. I remember them well.
Yeah, and we were one of their early customers. They had their magazine produced at the American Printing House up until they got their own studios. And they realized they could save money if they used, because the printing house used those old hard discs.
Yeah.
They could get more on each disc, and the discs were a whole lot cheaper if they used those little flimsy discs. So we converted them over in 72, 73, over to the thin discs.
And Dialogue at that time was a monthly or
it was a quarterly then, too.
Still a quarterly.
Yeah, I think it's been a quarterly during most of its history.
They've gone now to bi-monthly.
Have they?
Yeah. Yeah, I think starting this year, they're going to do bi-monthly.
I'll be darned. I subscribe, and I thought they were coming oftener. That's funny.
I thought you were getting them more often. That's
amazing. But I haven't had I have so much to read. You know, blind folks are in a wonderful position now.
Oh, man.
An embarrassment of riches. And I have so much to read, I don't get it all read anymore.
You can't. I find the other day I called the library and canceled a couple of magazines that I just don't. You know, used to, Consumer Reports was wonderful. I'd almost read it. Never read it cover to cover, but you'd go look up stuff. Now it's so much easier to do that online.
Yep, that's true. It's a great luxury to be able to pick and choose. I mean, we used to read everything we'd get our hands on because there were so little of it.
Yeah, that's true. Okay, Dial, you managed the recording studio there, and you obviously did some voice work for them.
That's right.
Read some pieces.
I read some of the pieces, and I wrote what I read, but I read some other people's pieces. We had volunteers who would come and work for us, and we auditioned them, and we had some regular criteria that would help us figure out whether to use a volunteer or send them a nice letter and, you know, tell them that we couldn't use them. They had to have good diction and they had to sound human and so forth and so on. Those were the things that we got together for them.
And dialogue never went out of business, but it went through a major change. A lot of people think, blind people don't think, dialogue's no longer around.
Well, it certainly is around.
It is.
It shifted. It's instead of being an independent, standalone, published out of the Chicago area, it went to Blind Skills in Oregon. But now it's an integral part of Blind Skills, and I think it's been continuously published since it moved out.
Yeah,
here.
I think so. Yeah. But you were there a good while.
I was there actually in Illinois until '83, and then I moved to Florida, and I started doing some work for Triformation. In those days, they made the LED, big old LED 120. And after a couple of years, I went to Associated Services for the Blind as Director of Services in Philadelphia. But even up there, I continued to write for Dialogue because there wasn't any conflict between writing for a consumer magazine and running the service division of an agency for the blind. So I did that until '87 when Dialogue did go through a financial crisis, and they really couldn't publish in the way that they had, and it was time for the board to downsize and, you know, figure out a new way to do it. And I think it took them about a year to get it converted and get it handed over to Blind Skills.
I did an interview with Carol McCarl when Nolan Crabb was out there, but I've forgotten. She told me the story of how she ended up with it.
She was a great friend of Don Knowles. Don was the founder. And Carol, when I moved up to work for Don... Don and Carol were associates in several organizations for the blind, and so I think it partly had to do with Don's wishes, that it went to somebody who shared a lot of his views and who understood what he was trying to do and who felt like she would try to do as many of the same things as another person could do.
But I guess it was the first independent that wasn't associated with the foundation or NFB or ACB or any of that. It was a first independent blind magazine.
That's right.
And quite well read, from what I hear.
An awful lot of people that I meet still remember, having read Dialogue in those years. And so I think it was probably more widely read than we knew at the time.
I've said something to my friend in Dallas, John Conley, about that Dialogue, because I wrote a little article for Dialogue that was published 3 or 4 years ago about a building I built. I was the contractor on this building, and I wrote about how the sighted people didn't like that at all. The blind guy, how could he possibly know? And I didn't know. I just stumbled along and got it done. But anyway, I wrote him a little piece, and I was telling him about this is in Dialogue, and he said, man, if you think Dialogue's good now, you should have read it 20 years ago. And I don't know what he's talking about, because I didn't read it. So you folks must have done a pretty fair job.
Well, we wrote about everything in those days that we could find out about. I mean, we wrote about technology, of course, but we also a lot of the departments are still there. But we also wrote about the politics of the blind.
Yeah,
I can remember going to New York City when the National Federation of the Blind hung the National Accreditation Council in effigy. That was in 1973, and I covered it directly. We had tape of the thing. They had a big bass drum beating a funeral march, and they had a ceremony burying it. And I did a long interview with Kenneth Jernigan, and it was very interesting. We published it, and so did the Monitor. And of course, and we published an awful lot of materials, similar kinds of political material that we got from the American Council of the Blind Convention. So that's what we used to do. That the dialogue doesn't touch now.
That they don't get into the politics of the blind now at all.
But nobody was covering them. You know, they covered themselves. They had their own magazines, and I thought it was just really a great challenge to cover them the way an independent news organization, a big one, might have done. And I enjoyed that, you know, for quite a long time, and I learned more about the National Accreditation Council and the charges that NFE made against it.
Now, what is or was the National Accreditation Council?
It's still NAC's still there, but it's much smaller than it used to be. It's the not-for-profit agencies that serve the blind because they raise money from the public.
Uh-huh.
There was a movement in the field in the 1970s to say, well, if the organization meets certain standards, then it should be worthy of public support. And if it doesn't meet those standards, then it should not be. But the National Accreditation Council wasn't really an independent organization. It was, in many respects, a child of the agencies that it accredited.
Okay.
And that was the consumer organization's big quarrel with it, one of them. The other organization didn't find so many faults with it. But it was a very interesting debate and a very important one. And I think some people at the time, at first, didn't really see the importance of the debate because accreditation didn't seem like that big a deal. But it was about who gets to decide what good services are and, you know, who gets to say these are good and these aren't good. And in if the consumer doesn't get a voice in that, then in a sense, you're raising money for my benefit, but I don't get any voice in how it's used.
And this national accreditation thing is still alive? I mean, it's still...
That's right. Yeah, there are still a handful of agencies who are accredited by it, but the Federation doesn't spend a whole lot of time fighting it or talking about it anymore because it's been in decline. Some agencies that were accredited have dropped accreditation. And it has ceased to grow.
So if I file for 501c3, when I get it and I start trying to raise a little grant money, will they come and accredit me and decide whether I'm doing good or bad?
It's voluntary.
Oh, it's voluntary. Okay.
You'd have to decide that you wanted NAC accreditation. And if you did that, you'd hear from some people who thought that was a bad idea.
Well, I'm not going to do that. But I did get a letter from the government with a lot of challenges to my ideas of my 501c3. I figured they looked at my voting record and figured out I'm a Democrat.
Good for you. So
I'm reasonably sure that's what they did because I didn't like it at all.
Well, you're an endangered species in Texas, aren't you? As a Democrat,
there's about four of us: me and my wife and one of her brothers. We family of Democrats.
I hope nothing happens to you because there aren't enough of you in Texas.
Oh, there aren't very many. That's you don't announce that in a public function. but there are two or three of us left. I think we might. We're looking pretty hard at we might actually win that Sugarland seat of Tom DeLay's.
I hope you do.
I hope we do too.
I'd be tickled as I say as a Democrat myself.
We've got a good man running for it, and I think we may take that away from him. His approval rating in his own district's down to less than 28%. So we're thinking we might get that, but I don't want to jinx it by saying anything.
Absolutely.
All right. So dialogue and these people in Florida made what did they do that you went to Florida and worked for them?
They made Braille embossers.
They made Braille embossers.
In those days, companies tended to branch out, so they also had something. They also had a Braille display related device, and they had a speech device. But the part of Triformation that survived into the 80s and 90s and now as enabling technologies was the Braille embosser part, the hard copy Braille part. And boy, you know, parts of my life have been spent wishing I could put some of these threads together, Phil, because that Braille hard copy would have made my radio announcing job a whole lot easier.
Oh, man, sure it would have.
And I think it makes the job of some people who are in radio easier. In fact, I've installed some devices in radio stations where blind folks work, and it tickles me to death. Luke Cobb, who's on the a Bookport list, I installed a Romeo in the radio station where he works.
I didn't realize he was in radio. I'll have to find him and and the interview. But they had some forms of primitive synthetic speech back then.
They did, and they had a teletype-like device in the 70s that would make Braille on tape, but nothing that you could rip and read the whole Braille teletype wire.
Whereas at UPI would feed your Braille teletype machine. I bet they have that now.
I'm sure they do.
I bet if UPI and AP are still around.
You'd have a couple choices, Phil. You could either attach an embosser and get that stuff out in hard copy, or you could probably attach any number of refreshable Braille display products or speech products and get it in memory and to do what you wanted to with it.
You could probably get it into text form and read it on. So now it would be so much easier now. So
it would.
They made Braille, but you realized early on that speech was going to be a big deal.
Yep.
And that we were going to have this technology.
That's right.
Whereas I didn't. I had no, when I first heard the first computer, I was just knocked over. I couldn't believe. And that was, that wasn't that long ago. Of course, I was in radio and I was the only blind person I knew, at the radio station, Anyway, so you went from there to Philadelphia.
That's right. Well, I gotta say, I was the only person I knew at the time I was doing it too.
Yeah.
That was back in the late 60s. And I was pretty sure somebody must have done it. I just didn't know who and I didn't know how. And so I invented all these things. I thought I invented a technique where I could play words through an earphone and say them on the air. And that's how I used to read the news.
Is that
Fred Cassoni calls that parroting. I mean, a lot of people invented that. It's
that's how I do.
Idea that we all had. I mean, I guess it's fairly obvious.
That's how I do copy still.
Exactly.
I was so thrilled when I bought, in 64, I bought a two-track MPEX PR-10 recorder, and I could have someone read the copy on one track, I could listen and do my voice on the other track, and then go back and put music on the first track.
Exactly.
I was just thrilled. That was
major. I did a lot of stuff for dialogue that way. We'd have volunteers come in and read it, and I'd take the volunteer's tape and put it on a cassette, and go in the studio, and I'd voice it in my voice, just using the earphone as a script.
I had a little tape recorder I carried around in my pocket. I'd take it up and get the traffic girl, read this piece copy into the tape recorder for me.
Yeah.
And she'd read it in the tape recorder. I'd go back in the production room, dump it to one of the tape recorder tracks, or just put a little earphone in my ear and do. And I've done thousands of commercials just like that. And now, of course, I can write copy on my computer and then put it on a track and read my own copy.
Exactly.
But, and a lot of people, I ran across a guy in California that's doing middays on Westwood One. It's on about 120 stations around the nation.
Is that right?
Yeah, that's doing radio. Sounds like, his name won't come to me right now, but a very bright fellow. He lost his eyesight. After he got in radio, he lost his eyesight, and they told him, we'll keep you, but you have to learn to do this independent. We won't have anybody sitting in there with you. And so he figured out how to do it. He's a voiceover. He does a lot of voiceover and does middays on Westwood One.
Well, now there's a lot of us around now. Ed Walker is a blind guy who works with WAMU in Washington, D.C., has for many years done their big broadcast program. And he's had a long career in radio in D.C. and is very, very well known and highly respected up there. And for good reason, he's a very, very capable guy.
Well,
so there are a lot of us around now, and it's great to have company, Phil.
I ran across a guy. I pitched XM Radio to run our little shows, Blind Like Me and Blind Handyman, and eventually to develop a channel for blind people. That would be a perfect thing for XM Radio. They have not seen the wisdom of doing that, but the guy, Mark Schramm, there did tell me that there's a blind guy working at NPR. I don't know who it is.
I don't know who that is. I don't know if Ed Walker may be who he means. Because WAMU is their flagship station. It's the station of American University. And they run all things considered, and they run all of Morning Edition because they originate on there. So he's probably talking about it.
Think he is?
Yeah, could very well be.
You know how to get a hold of Ed Walker?
I can probably figure it out.
Well, do that for me and let me interview him because that'd be a great interview.
Well, you'll enjoy that. He'll have a lot of great war stories to tell. I won't spoil him. I hope you do get him, and I'll try to help you do it.
I would appreciate that. We're getting close to the end here now. So you left Philadelphia. You went back
to Florida to work again. Now, instead of Triformation, now they call it Enabling Technologies. Went back there as vice president. A friend of mine that I had worked with down there at that company became the president, and he asked me to come to work directly with him, and we developed several new brailers while I was down there.
Mm-hmm.
I helped establish their customer support, and I wrote manuals for them, and even did some marketing. They had been through some difficult times, and that were not held in the best repute in some places. And I went around and got people to give us another chance.
Mm-hmm.
That was from 1989. I was there until 2004.
Well, then, Judd, you came to Mississippi where you are now.
That's right. I've been here for a year and a half, and I came from Enabling Technologies here.
Now, did you raise a family during all this time, or did you have the...
Well, I went through several lifetimes. My lovely wife has a son from a previous marriage, and uh-huh. so that constitutes my family.
That's it,
this point, yeah.
Well, it sounds like you've done a lot of things you wanted to do and are very well grounded. You seem to have done very well and not felt sorry for yourself, just went on and did whatever you wanted to do.
I took a lot of things that weren't quite what I wanted to do and made them into what I had been trying to do. I mean, and a lot of times I'd said, well, you know, this isn't what I want to do, but I'll live with it because I don't want to sit idle. And it's amazed me how often, with over time, it has turned into what I wanted to do in the first place. It's made me into an avowed opportunist. You know, I believe in taking the opportunities that are there. Very often, you can eventually make it into exactly what you want it to be.
I worked in the early 80s for an old, hateful old man that was running a radio station here. And that people ask you, why do you stay? I stayed with that old man because he didn't have an engineer. And I was the best engineer he had, and he let me be the engineer. And I got to go out to the transmitter and turn it off and look inside and see how it was made and how it was wired. I got to wire a studio, a complete radio station. We moved the radio station, and I built it, the new radio station. I never would have gotten to done that if I had let him get under my skin and quit him. You know,
I know just what you mean.
It was something I wanted to do. I wanted to be able to say I wired when you sighted folks are standing there at the board. Remember, I put it together.
Oh, the stuff that you talk about doing on the Blind Handyman, I'm in awe of that stuff.
You don't do handyman?
A lot of stuff you're able to do, and that a lot of your guests are able to do that I'm in total awe of.
Well, we've certainly learned a lot more from that show than than I've put into it. I've found some amazing blind people who do things I never thought blind people could do.
Well, the lesson it's taught me again and again is that, you know, most of us are good at something, but nobody's good at everything. And there's a ton of things that you find where people just totally outclass you. And I've learned to kind of enjoy it.
This week, we of course, this will be later when we run this, the week that we're doing this show, we have a guy on from St. Louis, Missouri, who takes locks apart. His wife has about 20 rent houses, and when someone moves out and doesn't give them the key, he finds an old key, takes the lock apart, makes that key work in the lock, and puts it back together. And knows all there is to know about it. I just went into this long, involved description of how to take a deadbolt apart. So he's just, you know, you can't go to school and learn that. He figured that out.
No, you can't.
You can't even buy the tools. You can't go to Lowe's and buy the tools to do that with. You have to, he said, well, you can find them on eBay sometimes, you know. So you know, normal people don't have those kinds of tools. So I've run a lot across the person that's gained the most from Blind Like Me and the Blind Handyman is me. Because I've met so many people I never would have run across had I not started doing these.
I can well understand that. But I have realized by meeting a lot of other blind people who are very similar to me that when as a kid, you have to sit around and you're not in control of your environment very much. If you ever once find a way that you can get in control of your environment, nobody's going to stop you.
You will not let go.
That's right.
and nor should you.
That's exactly right.
Well, I met you on the Bookport list, helping me with the problem I have. We've now figured out that you can play files made on the PlexTour PTR machines on the Bookport.
Yes, the MP3 files themselves will play. The challenge is that the first file that it puts in the directory, when you put that card in there, is not an MP3 file.
No, it won't play. But once you error down past that, So you people who have been recording stuff on Bookport and then carrying it, on Plextalk and carrying it around in its knapsack around your neck, buy yourself a Bookport and put it on your belt, and it'll play your... I listened to all my NPR programs last Sunday on my Bookport for the first time. I was as thrilled then as I was when I got that two-track machine back in the 60s.
That Bookport's a wonderful product. I love any product that'll do several things. And when I wrote about technology for dialogue, it was always in seeking and in praise of products that would do more than one thing, because you don't have room in your luggage for one product for every task. And the great thing about the Bookport is it'll do many things.
It will. It will do many things. There are things I don't like about it, but by and large, it's a good piece of equipment.
The compromises it makes in many cases are useful, and of course, as you say, it does fall short in some areas. But I love it for the fact that it will both read text and play audible files.
And we keep hearing rumors about the Bookport 2 that's coming out, but nobody knows, do they?
Well, as somebody's been involved with new technology manufacturer, I know these things have a long lead time. Just getting the parts, getting them created and getting them ordered has incredible lead times. And it leads to what we call vaporware, where you're talking about a product before it's really there.
Long before it's
there. It just
goes
with the territory, I guess.
Bradley Kimbrough, thank you, sir. I appreciate it. I'll give you a call before we run this, and keep on keeping on. Thank you.
My pleasure.
All right, sir. Talk with you.
All right.
Well, there is an example of a blind man who was able to do what he wanted to do. Not exactly the way he wanted to do it, but very able fellow, and see what I mean about being about gaining more from this than I put into it. Cause I never would have met that man had it not been for this doing these shows and meeting other blind people and learning. It's been a great experience, and let's don't stop. Let me remind you that Blind Mice Mart, our friend Dale Campbell, remember him? Has extended his offer on the T-shirts and caps until midnight Sunday night, this coming Sunday night, if you're listening to this on Friday and Saturday on ACB or on one of the radio reading services. He has extended his offer of the Blind Handyman T-shirt and the cap for both for $30. You can do it at blindmicemart.com, or you can call 713-876-6971. 713-876-6971. This is good through midnight on Sunday. He's going to place the big order, I think, on Monday. So be sure and order yours. You'll never get them this cheap again. A Blind Handyman T-shirt and a cap for $30. 877-713-876-6971 or blindmicemart.com. All right? And by the way, all the profits go toward a scholarship for blind high school students. We'll tell you more about that later. Anyway, if you want to be a guest on the show, give me a call, 936-634-9500, or email me phil@philpar.net. Thank you much. We'll see you next week for more Blind Like Me.